From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Parents, states away potentially, have no opportunity or right to know that their minor daughter has come to Illinois for an abortion. We have examples of 12-year-olds receiving abortions in Illinois. 12-year-olds.
I left home at 16 to escape my father's drunken anger. And I thank God every day that I didn't face an unintended pregnancy at that time.
Everybody who watches it, including the participants who are giving these nonsensical answers, know what's happening. It's stupid. The people of this state are not as stupid as they're being led to believe in these hearings.
Our political parties only survive by appealing to the most motivated and the most extreme elements within it. And the price tag to power has skyrocketed. And fear and distrust has served as an effective strategy to meet that cost.
Well, Democrats waited until the end of the fall session, but they passed through a new congressional district map. It had been redrawn some more. That prompted a quick response Friday morning. Congressman Adam Kinzinger, the outspoken Republican who has split from many within his own party when it comes to Donald Trump and the January 6th insurrection, he announced he will not seek re-election in a new district that will pair him against the fellow Republican Darren LaHood. We'll discuss the new map, also some changes in abortion law that are coming, and more on what took place over the week at the Statehouse during the fall session. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Emeritus Professor, former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime Statehouse reporter and observer. Also with us, Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois Statehouse Editor. And joining us today, we have Rick Pearson, the Chief Political Reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And Rick, it's always good to have you back with us.
Thank you for having me.
Rick, let's go ahead and start with the news that was breaking as we sat down to record. Adam Kinzinger leaving Congress when his term expires next year. I guess this was not a big shocker.
Well, you know, it's funny how the Democrats were treating Kinzinger and the various iterations of the congressional map. And it was kind of curious to see, you know, whether knowing that the state had to lose one congressional seat and go from 18 to 17, you know, where would Kinzinger fit into this? Wouldn't necessarily hurt Democrats to have a kind of a foe of the Republican establishment under Trump to be sticking around if there was a way to do it. But he's a pariah in his own party. He ends up getting mapped in with Darren LaHood, who is a staunch Trump supporter. The district sprawls all the way from the Wisconsin border, winds around the Democratic areas of Rockford and Peoria and Bloomington, and goes back up to Morris and the Chicago exurbs to pick up Kinzinger's district. I mean, it's prime Trump country, and there's no way that Kinzinger could survive a primary in that.
Charlie, a lot of Democrats have applauded Kinzinger for speaking out. Of course, he's on the current panel investigating January 6th. As Rick said, he's become a pariah, though, with many in his own party. But as I was looking online this morning to the news, just reaction to it, even seeing a lot of Democrats who were not happy with this, they felt like if you're going to have Republicans in Congress, this might be the type of person we want to have, somebody that's willing to call people out if they see wrongdoing. And your thoughts on that as far as, you know, how Kinzinger was treated under this new map by Democrats?
I think Kinzinger is in a position, as Rick said, where he's a pariah within his own party. And despite where the map may have put him, he could choose to run in any district in the state of Illinois. The requirement isn't that you have to live where you're running. You just have to live within the state. And there have been instances in the past of people who've run in other districts. But the problem that he faces is that he would probably have a hard time getting elected in a Democratic district because Democrats will applaud him for being anti-Trump. But on the other hand, people who are paying attention will say, well, he's a good guy, but he's a Republican. And when push comes to shove and it comes time to vote for a Speaker of the House, he won't be voting for Nancy Pelosi. And so they'll vote for the Democrat. And in the Republican districts, as was mentioned, he'd have a hard time winning in a primary against someone who is what would you say, more a fan of Donald Trump than he is. So I think, who knows, somebody speculated, well, maybe he's going to run for president. Well, I guess it's a free country. You can run for whatever you want, but it'd be interesting to see where he finally winds up.
Yeah, and Hannah, he did mention he issued a video Friday morning making his announcement. And in that video, he said this is not the end politically.
Yeah, that's some of what we heard at the top. And he definitely made sure to say it's not the end of his political career. But, you know, in, gosh, I can't remember if it was before or after the January 6th insurrection, but Kinzinger had formed this committee called Country First, and kind of committed to, you know, activism around those who, you know, feel partyless, I guess you would say, you know, those who used to be Republicans, but now feel as if their party has left them. And so, you know, that was always definitely some sort of, I thought, an exit strategy for him. I don't think we've seen the last of M. Kinzinger. I mean, is it possible that he leaves Congress, he gets comfortable, you know, in the private sector, family life, and he decides, you know, it's not actually worth it. This is a losing battle. That's a possibility. So we will see how far he takes it.
I mean, I took one thing out of his message about his future, where when he says why he's really not running for Congress is because he's been into this thing of describing himself as the truth tellers against the Republican establishment, and that the message is too broad. And so if it's too broad to be a member of Congress, then it's probably too broad to be anybody in a statewide office, that it's a national message that he wants to carry. And there's no doubt, even after his term in Congress ends, that he will be a frequent talking head on the TVs for the media looking for a Republican non-Trumper, particularly going into the re-election of 24.
Let's talk about that map real quick that has passed, because this was not the only, I don't want to say surprise, I guess nothing's really surprising when it comes to redistricting. It's done a lot behind the closed doors, and you see different versions come out. But Rick, did you see, you know, what else in here raised some eyebrows when it comes to how the districts are drawn?
Well, I mean, we've, you know, had the announcement too about Marie Newman, the freshman Democrat who beat Dan Lipinski 2 years ago in the southwest side and southwest suburbs of Chicago. And that was a very big progressive movement to get her elected. And you saw in the various iterations of the map what being the low person on the totem pole is, being the freshman. I think she was primaried against three different people in three different versions of the map. The last one that passed, she was put into a 67% Latino district against Chuy Garcia, and that was never going to happen. I mean, her district was basically blown up, and now she's announced that she'll be running against Sean Casten, the two-term Democrat from Downers Grove, in a district that's about, she says it's about 40% of her old Southwest suburban territory. You know, there was lots of consternation about that, about and hand-wringing among Democrats about if we're the party in power, and yeah, we do have to lose a seat, but why are we setting up primaries of one of our own against another when our goal is basically in a power play to try to maximize Democratic advantage, not only in the state congressional delegation, but to help in Washington, where the, you know, Democrats have that narrow edge that gives Pelosi the chair.
The answer to that question, Rick, would be to create a second district that's likely to elect a Latino congressman. And I look at it that four versions of the map that were made public, and if you recall, I think it was the very first one, only had one Latino district.
Right.
And you knew that's not going to happen. They go through all of this theatrical drama and all, and then they come back with a map finally that says, oh, now we have two Latino districts. And so to have two Latino districts, that means, given the nature of downstate Illinois, you probably have to sacrifice one of the incumbents in Chicago. Now, you're not going to eliminate a African-American incumbent because you run afoul of the Civil Rights Act. And so you have to choose somebody, and it's the low person on the totem pole, the freshman who gets chosen. And I think I looked at it as being a kind of a insulation about one of the likely charges that will be made when this map is challenged in court, that you didn't take into account what your constituents wanted. They can come in and say, well, yes, well, our original map only had one Hispanic district. And we listened to people who said, no, you have to have another one. And we adjusted it. So we did listen to what people told us. That was how I interpreted that.
And Charlie, I absolutely agree with you. As an insulation is a good word, because if there was, you know, if there's a likely point of challenge, it would have been on the lack of the map to recognize the growth in the Latino population. Yeah. And of course, as we've seen with the state legislative map, one of those who's opposing that is the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And these people are experts on redistricting challenges. And because I've had people say, well, you know, who is MALDEF? And I remind them that one of my early coverages of redistricting involved a representative from a lawyer from MALDEF whose name was Ruben Castillo. And Ruben went on to become chief judge of the U.S. District Court in Northern Illinois.
Taking a look at this map overall, Hannah, in the very early version, I believe, out of 17 districts that we'll have starting after the next election, we're looking at maybe 14 that could go to Democrats. Is that still the rough idea with this with the version that passed?
Yes, that is still, you know, they're winnable districts by Democrats. That doesn't mean that people won't have to work hard, but there's still, you know, 14 winnable districts. Districts like, for example, Sherry Bustos's Northwest Illinois district, that's been changed a lot to, you know, string together, you know, a decent amount of Democratic support. So it's not a lost cause. You know, same with the new 13th district, which is, you know, obviously Springfield, kind of designed for Nikki Budzinski, who, you know, very close with the governor, advised him on campaign and worked for a long time in D.C. So, yeah, I mean, that's the idea. I was looking at a lot of, you know, history last night of how the districts have changed, especially from one map to another. This is definitely, it was a big drastic change going from the Tea Party wave in 2010 that brought in, I think it was like four new Republicans to Illinois' congressional delegation, and then the remap 2011 that applied for the 2012 election undid all of those. So that was pretty drastic, but this is more drastic. And, you know, Democrats, as I think Rick said at the top, Democrats in DC are relying on blue states like New York and Illinois to do whatever they can with their redistricting processes to give Democrats, you know, any sort of advantage that they can find, because it's going to be a really, really tough road for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to remain in power, especially given the swift downturn in public opinion of President Biden. You know, these districts are not drawn with an eye to competitiveness. In fact, it is the exact opposite.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson. And before we leave this topic, Rick, just real quick, we, you know, have talked in this show in the past about who might challenge J.B. Pritzker for governor on the Republican side. There are already some people who have announced, but a lot of speculation on a Rodney Davis. Kinzinger's name has come up there. You sort of indicate you don't believe Kinzinger has interest in running for governor. Rodney Davis under this map looks like he may not, you would not expect him to run either?
Well, you know, it's an extremely solid district that was drawn for him, extremely solid Republican. The one question is there was like a little angle drawn that cuts out Mary Miller, and the map sets up a primary between her, a freshman controversial who plays to the far right, against Mike Boss from Murfreesboro. And the question is, you know, there's the possibility that she could opt to run in to that that new district that Rodney Davis has, which has, you know, some of her territory in it, and take him on there. So, I mean, I think that's one to watch. But otherwise, this would seem to be a perfect district for Rodney Davis. And he's one who said the Democrats are basically going to dictate my political fate. Well, the Democrats did him a great job to keep him in Congress.
Let's move on to some other things that did take place during the fall session here. Charlie, last week we had discussed possible changes to the Healthcare Right of Conscience Act, governor wanting to tighten up some exemptions there that are being used to get people out of COVID vaccines, testing mandates. Did they accomplish what they needed to with that?
Yeah, I think so. The legislation passed with just a few more votes than that needed to make it law in both the Senate and the House. And in my mind, it merely clarified a law that's been around for 40 some years that was enacted so that healthcare professionals, doctors, hospitals did not have to provide abortion services. And it was done largely at the insistence of Catholic lawmakers and Catholic bishops at the Catholic Conference of Illinois in the wake of Roe v. Wade, which made abortion services legal. And so that was the intent of it. And I'm sure when it passed back in the mid 70s, nobody was thinking of some kind of, what would you say, worldwide pandemic as we face now. I suspect back in the 70s, there were still people around who recalled going through the flu crisis in, what was it, 1918. Senior citizens would remember that perhaps, or younger people who know their parents or grandparents talked about it. But that certainly was not in the mind of anybody who was going to be voting on that back then. And it's been seized, it's been hijacked, if you will, by folks who just don't want to get the vaccine for whatever reason. Some of them, I think, have been misled into believing that the vaccine is some kind of a plot against them, that they'll be, I don't know, taken over by aliens if they get the shot, all kinds of goofy stuff. And the Republicans seem to have jumped on it and are repeating this kind of thing. And they say, well, it's my right. I don't have to do something I don't want to do. And I'm thinking to myself, do you wear a seatbelt? Do you observe the speed limit?
Well, people fought against those too when they pass.
Well, yeah, but now nobody argues that, well, I have a right not to wear my seatbelt. It's my constitutional right. And therefore, if you're going to fine me, it's illegal.
Well, Hannah,
okay. I thought a good one was when I think it was the Senate President Don Harmon said, you know, what you're arguing, for example, if you're stopped for drunk driving, can you say, oh, my conscience doesn't allow me to do the breathalyzer test?
Yeah, and Hannah, there is an effective date for this change to take effect. So there's a window here. We're likely, I believe you've reported, we're likely to see more lawsuits bringing this act into those lawsuits.
Now, I should note, you can't mandate vaccines in law unless it's fully authorized by the FDA, and we only have one of three vaccines that are fully authorized. That notwithstanding, you know, the frenzy of, you know, fear and anger over this that you know only social media can whip up really, you know, spooked a lot of Democrats, I would say. That and, you know, some other pre-existing beliefs that some of them might have, but it was very interesting to see that even with a an updated amendment that was supposed to kind of soften it, that was supposed to kind of bring some more Democrats on board so it wouldn't fail. They were still not able to get the required number of Democrats for an immediate effective date, meaning that, it would go into effect in June, which is a long time for all of these copycat lawsuits to pile up and again chip away at the governor's pandemic strategy, because it's not just about vaccine mandates. It's being used to say, we don't have to get tested for COVID. We don't have to even wear masks. That's the argument of a group of teachers downstate. The Democrats want to try again in January when the vote threshold isn't so high anymore, because we're in this special period after May 31st. But, there are no assurances, and we'll see what happens. But, in these next 2 months, will the number of copycat lawsuits get so onerous that other things start falling apart? Or, maybe COVID will get better. We can all hope. And, we won't, we won't need as many restrictions, or maybe we won't have to wear masks anymore, or anything like that. But in the meantime, it's a big question mark. And this is definitely a failure on the part of the governor's office and, their legislative strategy.
What's going to happen? The most likely thing is that the legislature has 30 days to send the law or the bill to the governor. He has 60 days to act on it. And I would not at all be surprised, but what Governor Pritzker uses an amendatory veto to say, I agree 100% with what this bill is trying to do. Codifies what has been the accepted knowledge for 40 years about what this is about. And I'm going to use the mandatory veto to give it an immediate effective date. And the legislature can come back one day in January and accept that immediate effective date. The proliferation of lawsuits, one of the things that you would have to take into consideration, anybody can file a suit. The only requirement is that you can pay the filing fee. And ultimately, all this stuff is going to get resolved by the Illinois Supreme Court. And the Illinois Supreme Court will look at, here's what the legislature did. The majority of the lawmakers said that this does not apply to COVID-19. And they said that flat out. So we're going to say all these suits, fine and dandy, but we're tossing them all.
Well, just about a minute left here. Rick, another big piece of legislation that moved through, Illinois' really last restriction on abortion in the state, and that was the parental notification law. Lawmakers also voted to repeal that.
Yeah, and it's kind of a fascinating issue, because here you've got Illinois, who's at the forefront among many of the states when it comes to abortion rights, even enshrining a fundamental right to a woman's right to an abortion in state statute. And here you have this 1975 era law on the books that dates back to when Republicans controlled Springfield, and or 1995 law rather. And you really are looking at the issue, and in some ways it's kind of like the issue of right of conscience. It's the abortion rights and running up against parental rights. And, things were different in 1995 when that law was passed. And I think, society has changed. People have a greater recognition of not everybody is living in Ozzie and Harriet world, as some Republicans viewed it in 1995. Republicans still staunchly opposed to any extension of abortion rights here. But nevertheless, this even had some Democrats on the fence over, is this taking things just a bit too far?
All right. The governor says he will sign that into law. And it's time now for our notes from the field. And Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, the legislature passed without as much, attention as was focused on the testing mandates, vaccinations, remap, and all that stuff. By very wide margins, very little opposition, a pretty far-reaching package of economic incentives that Governor Pritzker wanted, tax credits and other incentives that were supposed to or encourage the development of the electric vehicle industry in Illinois. And the bill is called the Reimagining Electric Vehicles in Illinois. And it would provide that businesses involved in the electric vehicle industry, automakers, parts manufacturers, battery producers, would be eligible for income tax credits based on the number of new jobs that they create. And it comes just a few days before the governor is heading to London and Glasgow to brag about Illinois' climate leadership and make a pitch for green companies to come locate in Illinois. And now he's got this package of incentives.
Okay, Hannah?
Well, lawmakers passed another update to Illinois' gaming laws, and this one would do a couple of things. It would allow for a pilot period where folks can bet on in-state college sports. That was left out of the original sports betting legalization bill in 2019. It would also prevent municipalities from implementing their own so-called push taxes, this penny per play tax on video gaming terminals. You know, it's become a little bit of a worrying trend. You know, the towns that have already done it are grandfathered in, but, you know, the purpose of this video gaming at the end of the day is to shore up money for infrastructure projects. And then in that same vein, it would also, you know, do a couple things around sports betting. It would, you know, allow the Winchester Arena to be a location for that, but then also allow for online registration. You know, you won't have to go to a casino in person anymore. That was another thing in the 2019 law that folks feel like we're leaving money on the table because people don't necessarily want to go to a casino just to register. And so that will be up and running, I think, by March Madness time.
Okay. And Rick?
I thought it was interesting in the vote for the congressional map, and as we talked about the creation of a second Latino district in the state, that the lone Democratic absolute no vote in the House was Democratic State Representative Angie Guerrero Cuellar. And she actually is interesting in herself because she is the replacement for the embattled former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. She contended that mapmakers didn't do enough to shore up the Latino representation from her district, and that it was, she felt disrespected because the Latino population has grown so much representative in this state. I'm kind of curious to see how this plays out because for the most part, the Latino caucus in Illinois was hugely supportive of the efforts to create a second Latino district, even if that meant carving into Chuy Garcia's lone Latino district. And even though in the past, Garcia, when he wasn't in Congress, supported a second congressional district, I'm not so sure he was so happy about having to give up some territory now.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week, and our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Rick Pearson with the Chicago Tribune. You can get a podcast of our show through nprillinois.org, the NPR One app, or iTunes. And don't forget to join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.